I would definitely put it in the top 10.
It's so good.
A lot more thought has gone into the story.
I think it's awesome.
This is a spy movie disguised as a superhero movie.
There's such clear-cut good and bad.
It's definitely got some horrific elements.
Well, once we go there, you're just going to throw physics out the window.
That's not how this works. That's not how any of this works.
This is like the Fast Times at Ridgemont High of the fantasy world. Yep. Wow. That was something else. Now, kids, your homework tonight is to go home and watch this on television.
At that point in the script, you're actually rooting for her.
And I am just giggling maniacally through the whole thing.
When slashers came home.
I love that they just throw you in there and say, okay, find your way out. A lot of people don't like horror movies.
It's a coming of age, not a horror movie.
But I still love it because it's a slice of life, and I'm okay with that. Tim really wants to like this movie.
I loved the production design.
I wanted more from this movie.
Your reality is not what you think it is.
Oh my God, am I destroying our podcast?
If the future were in your hands.
The daughter's screaming. The house is burning.
Would you change it?
It's not too late.
Touch this man's hand, and you are in the grip of the Dead Zone.
I've had another episode.
Only the imagination of author Stephen King could take you there.
Johnny, wait!
With a power that alters the future lives of those you love.
You want to kill your own son?
I want you out of here.
I'm scared, Dad.
Or of those you fear.
I have had a vision that I am going to be president of the United States someday. Nobody.
I mean, nobody.
Gonna stop me.
Is it a power for good or for evil?
If God has seen fit to bless you with this gift, you should use it.
Bless me?
You're a devil. Send for me.
Who are you?
Who sent you?
I'm scared,
sir. We're gonna get married, Johnny. Don't leave me, please.
Don't you see how clear it all is? Not only can you see the future,
I can change it.
Stephen King, The Dead Zone.
Hello and welcome out there in podcast and YouTube land. You've reached Johnny Has the Keys, a podcast and YouTube channel where two guys get together. We talk about horror, science fiction, movies, television, sometimes literature are all combined key influences, hence the key in the title of that particular topic of the week, and then things that topic may have influenced going forward, key elements of it, all kinds of examination of it. If you're new to us, welcome. We're glad you're here. We'd love to know how you found out about us. Leave a comment down below with your, let us know how you heard about us. And if you're returning, yay, you're probably used to the way we have this wonderful unscripted format and don't even know what we're saying ourselves, let alone to each other, sort of thing for most of these episodes. I'm here with my good friend, Tim. Tim, icebreak us for us. Get us into this week.
I will icebreak us with a question.
Yeah.
What do you think my genre week's going to be about?
Something horrific, something with the Master King in it? I don't know.
No, but that's a good guess.
Yeah.
I'm actually going to talk a little bit about a movie I revisited that was the first feature film of a young man named David Cronenberg. It's called Shivers.
Wow. Okay. Interesting.
I thought I had not seen this movie before, but I remembered it shortly after I started it. It's just been decades since I'd seen it. It's vintage Cronenberg body horror stuff, exactly what you would expect. However, it's a lot like Dawn of the Dead and Alien at times, which is interesting because this movie precedes both of them.
Yes.
And he even came after, I think, Ridley Scott a little bit about some of the alien stuff, the parasite being inside a human, that kind of thing. But all in fun, I'm sure.
Okay.
This is low budget, though, and it all takes place mostly in an apartment building.
Is this the Marilyn Chambers one?
No, that's Rabbit.
Rabbit.
That's a different one. No, but like Rabid, which I think had different titles, this movie had a bunch of different titles, too. It was written under the title of Orgy of the Blood Parasites.
And see, why would you not go with that title?
Well, and then it was filmed under the working title of The Parasite Murders.
Okay.
In the United States, they changed the title to They Came From Within, which Cronenberg did not like it all. He said it was too clunky. And he said he also did not really like the title Shivers, but he couldn't think of anything else, so he just let it go.
I just want to know where the thought process getting from Orgy of the Blood Vampire Parasites to Shivers. I mean,
it's passed through sex a lot in this movie.
Okay.
And when I said it's a lot like Dawn of the Dead, there are scenes where a guy is running from masses of people that are like chasing him like zombies, trying to get him and that kind of thing. But the parasite element is what's more like the Alien movie from 79. The cast is okay. There are some seemingly familiar faces. Barbara Steele, number one, is a very familiar face. We just saw her in Black Sunday a few weeks back. But it also has Joel Silver, Lynn Lowry, and Alan Coleman. Now, some of these are Canadian actors, so that's why I say seemingly familiar. You would probably remember them from a movie we caught in the 80s or 70s. The reason I appreciate it, though, a little more now than I did then is because of the cinematography and sound. I take that back. The sound's not so great, but you can see David Cronenberg in the movie.
Okay.
You can see what he's going to become, like what we're going to talk about a little bit later. A synopsis is, a scientist creates a genetically engineered parasite that turns residents of a luxurious Montreal apartment complex into mindless, sexually crazed fiends. The infection spreads rapidly through violent sexual contact, turning the isolated building into a chaotic, orgiastic nightmare.
Ooh, there you go.
This movie gets 85% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's not that great. I would give it a 70. It's definitely worth exploring, though, to see where Cronenberg came from. And then I have one little thing I'm going to read verbatim that I think you'll find interesting.
Sure.
David Cronenberg laments not having the benefit of CGI to make the slug look better or at least erase the wires. But he is okay with it as a product of its time. Unlike George Lucas, I have no desire to go back and correct it with modern technology. Let it live in the time that it existed with all the flaws, because that's where it belongs.
Here. Thank you, David, for that. That was excellent.
I thought that was interesting.
Yes.
I knew you'd like that, though.
That is
anyway, that's what I did in my genre week. A little bit of David Cronenberg.
That's a good one. I did, because of my commute back and forth to the theater, I've been doing a lot of audiobooks, everybody knows that, or when I'm not doing podcasts, and I stumbled upon, for some reason, I guess because of the lovely algorithm, my Audible came up with, we have all of these Arthur C. Clarke short stories that are being read by Ray Porter, one of your favorite audiobook readers or narrators. And he's redone all of these Arthur C. Clarke short stories, and they're all free. And I went, what? So I downloaded 40 of them. They're amazing. Some of them are an hour long. Some of them are 14 minutes sort of
thing.
Are
they in a collection or individual?
They are all individuals. They kept popping up. But some of them I had read before that are classic Arthur C. Clarke short stories that have gone on to be talked about in science fiction realms and everything else, like Rescue Party, The Last Command, Time's Arrow, a bunch of these that are very, if science fiction, especially 50s and 60s science fiction literature, they come up a lot. They're always in the Hall of Fames and all of that. But some of them were just... It just strikes me great writing. Some of them have plot twists at the end. Some of them, what's going to happen from the very beginning is just the way he tells the tale. Others are just character studies of two or three people or a crew on a ship and how they interact, and the crew dynamics are really most of the plot thing. And the whole time I'm listening to them, I just keep going, there is so much stuff out there. Why are we even no knock against Flanagan or anything else, but why are we redoing other things when we have this plethora of literature to pull from that we could be doing new series, new movies, new whatever. And it's just everybody wants a franchise. Everybody wants something that's already been done that has a built-in audience. And I'm seeing it everywhere. There are three groups right now in East Tennessee doing Steel Magnolias. All three in one little baby area of the country. Why are you That's redoing crazy. That play yet again? And a friend of mine went, I want to audition, but I can't because I'm involved in this other show. I said, don't worry about it. If you wait two more years, somebody else will do it again because they want something that's established and go see again in a franchise.
Or even if it's not new, go find something along the same lines that's not being done, like Crimes of the Heart or
right.
something.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff out there.
Right. You know, August Osage County. I don't know. I've never seen that.
But. Theater in general is redone. That's the point. You pick a play that's already been on Broadway or off Broadway or in a university and you redo it sort of thing. But movies and television don't have to be. They can be new stuff. And I wish more of them were, especially with the way Hollywood is now and everything not getting greenlit unless it's a $40 million an episode thing that goes on that's a retread of something else. Even down to they're redoing Harry Potter and turning it into a television series.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
And I'm like, okay. Goes along. I was going to save this for another genre topic, but I'll do it now. I started in my Audible journey this week to listen to the new, they've done this new dramatized version of the Harry Potter novels. So they are completely sound effects and surround sound and multiple cast and everything else. Totally dramatized. And I can't do it. I listened to an hour of the first book, and I am so used after 10 years plus of these characters that I've seen in these movies, I can't listen to other people play. I can't listen to anybody other than Alan Rickman play Snape. I can't listen to a different Dumbledore other than the two that did it thing, or Robbie Coltrane as Hagrid, or any of that. I'm so used to their voices and the way they sound and the way they look. That's why I think when this new Harry Potter thing comes out, I'm going to dislike it. I don't want to be that get off my lawn guy, but I...
Yeah, it makes me worry about The Mist.
Like yeah.
Flanagan's remake of The Mist, and that movie is not old at all.
No. And it's great. And people talk about how
good it is. It's about the same era as the Harry Potter films.
Yeah. The only negative I usually hear about that movie is some of the CGI.
People don't like it. Oh, I hear the ending. People don't like the ending at
all. I love the ending. And I think a lot of people love the ending. Yeah.
Yeah. We did it on the show. We talked about it.
Good or bad, whether you like it or not, it's memorable. That's a memorable ending.
It is. I'm hoping that he turns it into a series. They did a series of it that I never watched because I heard it was terrible. But yeah. I was thinking if anybody could elaborate on that world, it would be Mike Flanagan. So it'd be interesting to see what he does. But who knows?
I don't know what his take will be on it. I'm wondering if he'll do less Monsters in the Mist and more Monsters Among Us, which he's really good at doing.
He is good at that.
And we know who right now could easily play Carmody. It's the same lady who always plays his religious obsessed.
Yeah. Oh, the one you hate so much.
Oh, my God. Yeah. From Midnight Mass, Hill House.
I can't think of her name. I mean,
she's always the same type of character.
And she's in everything he does, almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the girlfriend in it should be his wife. I think so. Yeah, he's already set. It's good.
Well, and he's great at characters, and there's so many good characters in that movie that are trapped in the store. But I would hope that he will go along the lines of Hill House and expand on it and make it something bigger than what the original is. Because I'm sure he's a fan of the Frank Darabont movie. He's got to be.
Oh, yeah. He's mentioned it in interviews. He said.
Okay.
Because the first interview after the announcement, the first interview I saw that had mention of Flanagan was people asking him about the ending. Are you going to use King's ending or Darabont's ending, which King said was better than his ending? And he said, we'll have to wait and see.
King didn't have an ending. King's just stopped.
Yeah, literally.
And Darabont put an ugly exclamation point on it. And now Mike will probably do something different, I would think.
Probably. Right. Yeah, but we'll see. Yeah. But anyway, that's we'll when see. I did science fiction hoping with
digress.
With the inflect that hopefully more people would look back to classic literature, which again, that's a soapbox I get on with Star Trek too. Star Trek, what made the original series so good was he talked to science fiction authors and had them write scripts and stories, not a bunch of kids sitting in a writer's room saying, you know what would be cool? It'd be cool if they could just like transport upstairs instead of having steps. That'd be cool, wouldn't it? And it sucks. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Go make a bologna sandwich.
Yeah. Right.
Oh, wow.
Segway.
I have a perfect segue because I covered in my genre topic another picture by Mr. David Cronenberg. And today we actually digressed a little bit talking about Stephen King just now. And we're fixing to do 1983's The Dead Zone. We're going to talk about it. This is the first Stephen King movie we have covered since Christmas in season 6, back when we did The Mist, Gerald's Game, and It 1 and 2.
So wow.
We haven't done a Stephen King in a while. Yeah, it's been a couple seasons. Yeah. This one, as I mentioned, came out in 1983. It's directed by David Cronenberg. A brief synopsis is you have Johnny Smith and his love. I can't even remember her name.
Sarah.
They're teachers at the same school. They're in love. It's quite obvious. They go to an amusement park one day after school. He has a headache on the roller coaster, and later on, as he's dropping her off, she invites him in for the night, and he turns her down. And it turns out to be a very fatal error in a Stephen King world, because Johnny is in a car accident on the way home and knocked into a coma for 5 years. And while he's asleep, his girlfriend, Sarah, gets married, has a kid, and a lot of things change when he wakes up and finds out that he has been pretty much out of the picture for 5 years. He's not the most positive of people. He feels pretty much that life is shit on him. But he also woke up with a power of psychic ability where whenever he touches someone, he can either see something that has happened to them in the past, the present, or the future. The title comes from The Dead Zone, which he discovers later on in the movie, where he has a bit of space where he can alter the future from, if he sees something that's going to happen, maybe he can prevent it. And he does, actually. There's an incident with a boy that he is tutoring, and he sees that the ice is going to break in a hockey game that kid's going to play in, and he sees that kids are going to drown, and he prevents it. Not to the father's liking, though. The father is very upset that his son would believe him and not want to play hockey, and then these kids die and his son doesn't. And I don't know. There's a lot of other examples. There's an example where he is still in the hospital and touches a nurse and realizes her house is on fire and that she has time to go home and save her daughter. And he basically does not beat around the bush and makes her go do that. He tells his doctor, Dr. Wisneck, isn't that his name? Wisneck, I think, that his mother is still alive, that she survived the Holocaust in Germany, and that she is living very near, and that her phone number is in the phone book. Several incidents like this. Probably the most memorable is there's a Castle Rock killer. This is one of the first Castle Rock stories Stephen King wrote. And the sheriff comes to him. He says, I'm at my wit's end. Can you help me out? And he at first doesn't, but then he decides he will. And we discover that the killer and the reason he is so easy to not be caught is actually the deputy of the sheriff that asked Johnny to help him.
Yep.
Frank Dodd, another very memorable character. But as I mentioned, the kid that he saved from the ice hockey accident, when he's meeting with his father, who's a very rich man, he meets a political candidate named Greg Stilson, played by Martin Sheen. And when Johnny touches Greg, he sees that Greg becomes president and basically pushes the red button and launches all the nuclear stuff. And he has a conversation with his doctor. If you could go back in time and prevent Hitler from being around, would you kill him? if you knew what he was going to do? The doctor says, absolutely, I would. And Johnny decides to take on that sacrifice and to assassinate Greg Stilson and prevent him from becoming the president of the United States. And he doesn't succeed, but Greg ends up holding not only a baby, in the book it's just a baby he uses as a human shield that basically ruins him because it's on the cover of Time and no one's going to vote for a guy that would use a baby to protect himself. But in the movie, which is, this is a really good screenplay, I think, the way they did this, it ended up being the baby of his ex-girlfriend who holds it. She's like campaigning for him and he just snatches it out of her hands and holds him up. Anyway, Johnny does not kill Greg because the baby's in the way. He gets shot and he dies, but before he dies, he touches Greg one last time and sees that he does not become president and that he kills himself.
Yep.
Anyway, I rambled on and on, but that's the end of the movie. So I've pretty much told the whole story. I've spoiled everything. So if you haven't seen this movie that is now 40 something years old,
oops,
then yeah.
Yeah.
Spoiled it.
Yeah.
What's your memory of this movie?
I remember reading this book before I saw this movie. I liked the book. I thought the book was very strong. It was really cool because he like touched at political stuff without it being a political thriller. It really wasn't. It was his huge character study of regret and redemption and all this stuff with Johnny, and I liked it. I remember watching the movie, and I think I might have seen it in a theater. I definitely saw it on videotape, which is normal back then.
We were going to all those Stephen King movies back then, because like in 83, like six came out or something. It was crazy how many were coming out.
It's like now this resurgence of Stephen King material. Yeah. But I've never been a big Christopher Walken fan. I think he's unique, but so is Nicolas Cage, and I don't like him that much either. They each have their, it's hard to not like them for what they do and the amount of character work they are able to put on screen and everything else. It's just wonky to me and everything. And we mentioned, I think, last year when we did Dune, that I think he was horribly miscast in Dune. But I didn't change my opinion after watching this movie. I never pictured when I was reading the novel anybody even similar to Christopher Walken being Johnny Smith. And I don't know if he won me over in his portrayal, so to speak. But it was very interesting revisiting it again now. After doing the podcast all these years and examining movies, it was really neat to go back and look at it and look at the decisions that they made and how they adapted and what they did stuff. It's still a very strong Stephen King movie. I think it's very underrated.
One of the best.
Yeah.
I think. Yeah. And I have different thoughts about it, but very similar to you as far as then and now. Back then, everyone was saying, oh, the roles should have been reversed. It should have been Martin Sheen as Johnny Smith and Christopher Walken as Greg Stilson. And I think I may have even said that. And now that I watch it again, I'm like, no, this is perfect. They did not need to. David Cronenberg knew what he was doing because Martin Sheen is a smarmy politician. Christopher Walken could not do that. He's not got the charisma to do it. He's not got the good looks to do it.
No, Christopher Walken, you would have known is a villain from the minute you saw him.
Yes.
Whereas Martin Sheen comes across as just a smarmy little puppet. You just don't like him. But then you realize, no, you don't like him because of that scene with the – one of my scenes, that scene with the newspaper guy, which sets up how villainous this character is and what he's willing to do to become president and everything else is really great. And but he's smiling the whole time. And takes the guy's family picture and throws it against the wall and shatters it, and he's smiling, and you're just going, ooh, that's terrifying. Especially in today's modern age. That's scary politicians. Yeah.
I do have some stories of seeing this, a story of seeing this movie. And it's funny because I remember I always associate The Dead Zone and Cujo because they came out close together in books and they came out close together in movies. And I saw Cujo with Jerry Walters. I remember that.
Wow.
But I saw Dead Zone with Chris Derman. And I was a jerk. But the minute Sarah says, drive carefully, I laughed because I knew what was going to happen. And Chris literally nudged me and was like, thanks, asshole. But literally, the very next scene, he hits a milk truck and wakes up 5 years later.
Which is memorable. I don't think I've seen anything like that since, with the whole cab coming up over the horizon.
Great miniatures.
The actual rig itself. Yeah.
And he crashes into it and milk comes out.
Yeah.
It's like a giant milk truck. Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, white is definitely the color of this movie. If you had to pick a color.
Yeah, it's very bleak.
Yeah.
A lot of snow. A lot of cold weather and white
overcast.
Skies.
Overcast. Yeah. Yep.
And then other than those that first time seeing it with Chris Darwin, I saw it on videotape a lot. I use this movie as a landmark because prior to this movie, I didn't really like David Cronenberg. And this movie made me like him and going forward because the very next movie he did was The Fly.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yes.
Yep. So this, to me, was a turning point for David Cronenberg. And no wonder. Look at the freaking cast. This movie has a ton of great people in it.
Yeah.
And most of them are genre actors, except for Christopher Walken and Greg Stilson. Listen, yeah. Martin Sheen. Everyone else is like a genre actor.
Oh, yeah.
Or could be. Speaking of Steel Magnolias, Tom Skerritt's in it. But so anyway, I can do a little more on background.
Let's or scenes. See. Any scenes you've done?
The last time we saw David Cronenberg was in a little movie called Nightbreed, which we did just a few episodes back as well.
We did. Yep.
Because David Cronenberg is an actor as well. I read that he turned down Star Wars Episode 4, Return of the Jedi. Excuse me, Episode 7.
Seven.
No, six.
Six.
I don't know Roman numerals, sorry.
Six,
Return of the Jedi in favor of this film, which we just talked about how David Lynch turned down Empire Strikes Back, I think, to do Blue Velvet. Or was it? No, it would have been this. It would have been Return of the Jedi as well. So it's like, why are they going after David Cronenberg and David Lynch to do Star Wars movies?
It's George Lucas.
That's just
who knows?
Weird.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm glad he did because I like this film. Jeffrey Boehm is the screenplay writer. He wrote Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, which is a really good Indiana Jones movie.
Yes.
He died young of heart failure from a rare lung disease. I did not know this, but I think this is an excellent screenplay. I think it's one of the better Stephen King screenplays out there.
Yeah, research I did on it was that originally it was in development with Lorimar. And I can't remember his name now, but the guy that directed Singing in the Rain was going to direct it. And Boehm was going to write the screenplay, and Lorimar was going to produce. And they went into like almost fourth draft area. So they had it pretty well tightened up and good to go. But the director ended up quitting, getting off the project. Lorimar ended up going under. So De Laurentiis bought it like uber cheap.
Of course.
And one of Baum's big suggestions was streamlining all of the visions. So the visions basically streamlined to three basic ones, which is the Castle Rock killer, the whole family tragedy one, and then Stilson. So the hockey, the murderer, and Stilson. I wanted to go back and check, but there are other prophecies or other visions that Johnny has in the novel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure. I don't remember them offhand, but there are other ones in the movie too, including the nurse.
The nurse.
And including this one guy that in a press conference goes up and starts bullying him and sits next to him. And Johnny says, "You really want to know what's going to happen?" And just grabs his hand and says,
"Oh, yeah.
You want to know why your sister killed herself?
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it had something to do with you." Yeah, that's a great scene.
That is a good scene.
So, yeah, there's more prophecies in this as well.
Yeah.
As far as the novel, it was written in 1979. It was Stephen King's first book to hit number one. So he had several books before this, but this was the first one to hit number one. And I think it's because it's a little less horror or supernatural than the predecessors. But who knows? I could be out of my mind because now anything he does hits number one.
Yeah, I can see that.
It was 428 pages long. I've got all the stuff you just said about Lorimar and De Laurentiis. Apparently, before Cronenberg was approached, John Badham and Michael Cimino were both approached.
Yeah.
Michael Camino, did I say it wrong?
Yeah.
Badham turned the project down because he said he found the storyline irresponsible. Maybe he was, you think he was more of a conservative politician.
Or maybe there weren't enough car chases in it for him. Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, that's all I have on background. We can talk scenes.
The fire vision is one of my first scenes. I loved it. I think it's great. I love the fact that he puts Johnny into the scene immediately almost. And that was a really cool idea. And looking at research, that actually came from Cronenberg. Cronenberg didn't want just a POV of Johnny in this and or just to go to a scene that he's worked, like watching it. He wanted Johnny to become a part of each of the visions that he had. And even down to his freaking arm and the bed are on fire.
That special effect is really cool because he looks like he's sweating buckets.
Yes.
And that's actually an anti-flame retardant that's on his skin.
Oh, that's a cool idea. Yeah. That looks great.
They sprayed him with something to keep him from catching on fire, and it makes it look like he's sweating. Yeah.
But yeah, that whole scene with the little girl screaming and Amy. Mm-hmm. Amy is screaming. Whoever.
Amy.
I think it was Amy.
I think it is Amy.
The fishbowl starting to boil and then exploding. Yeah. It was really good.
That's a little bit much, but yeah.
Yeah. Amy would be dead if the fishbowl exploded.
If it was that hot, she would be blistered. But yeah, that's great. Back to what you said, in another scene is the scene where they go and find cigarette butts that the killer supposedly smoked, and he doesn't pick up anything off of them. And they get a call that they found another body. So he goes with them to investigate the body found in a gazebo. Mm. And that's really well done, like you said, where he is in the actual scene. And you start to realize it's Frank Dodd, but you don't see him from the front. You only see him from behind. But Johnny's standing behind him as he's talking to the girl, and she's not afraid. She knows him. And she walks up, and of course he kills her. And then Johnny, like, he's so there, actually jumps and tries to stop it from happening. And that's when it cuts back to the present, and Sheriff Bannerman is pulling him off, saying, you know, because he's lying on the dead body, basically.
Yeah.
And Bannerman, by the way, is the same sheriff from Cujo. I don't know if you remembered that or not.
I did not.
Not the same actor. But
that's great.
Bannerman's in both those books. Yeah, they're both Castle Rock books.
But speaking of Dodd, I think I, for years, could not forget the scissor suicide of Dodd. That is just such a way to do it. And I don't think that's in the book.
No, it's not. That is the only indulgence, I would say, by the part of David Cronenberg, because there is no way you could kill yourself doing that. You might severely maim yourself or be institutionalized because you have brain damage, but I don't think you could kill yourself by impaling your face on a pair of scissors.
I think you could. Obviously, Dodd died.
He did. And you know what? He was very considerate to his mother because he put on a raincoat before he did it and got in the bathtub.
Got in the bathtub.
So that he wouldn't get blood on the floor.
He's so considerate the way he did that. And the way he did it with, you know, he hooked the edge because they're like barber scissors. So they have that little hook.
They're tiny.
Weirdness. But he puts it, wedges it in the edge of the counter open, and then takes his head like this and puts his hands behind his head, and you think he's going to slam his face on that. But instead, he does it really slow. And I went, okay, I would have bought it if he had slammed his face, but the really slow I didn't buy.
If you look at that picture behind me, it's clear those scissors are not that deep. I don't think they would even reach his brain.
All the way up his palate.
And not to mention your teeth. Your teeth would block them.
I think one went up his nose, too.
That's what I'm saying. Know. Yeah, whatever. Anyway, it's very effective because it does make you squirm when you see it.
It does do that.
I've got to say the scene where Johnny smashes the vase and says, "The ice is going to break." Because I have said that line forever and ever since. It's one of my favorite movie lines.
Yep. Yeah.
And it's classic Walken overacting.
I would say my next scene would be the Stilson vision. That is, I remember that just being chilling when I read it. It's chilling the way Sheen does it. It is just, you just go, oh my gosh. When he does that whole, gentlemen, the missiles are flying. Hallelujah. And hallelujah. I just go, holy shit. That it still scares me to this day that a world leader would have that power. But they right. do, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, terrifying.
And any other scenes? There's so many good scenes in this movie. Even the photography alone, like that shot behind me where Dodd is behind Sheriff Bannerman and Johnny, and they're looking at the scene of the last murder where they're going to let him feel the cigarette, whatever. And the whole time, if you've known this movie and seen it a million times, you're watching Dodd because you want to see how he's reacting.
Yeah.
Because we know he's the killer. And Cronenberg does a great...
And Cronenberg does a great job of nodding to it, of having having reaction shots from him and showing him smoke at one point.
And but look at that shot right there. It's like a shot out of Let the Right One In or one of those. It's just beautiful the way the arch tunnel of is
that
lit.
Tunnel.
Yeah, yeah, it's great.
And that's a real tunnel in Ontario where they filmed that on location. My only last scene would be just Cronenberg's choices in the whole final fight or Johnny's death, from the different POVs he does of picking up the baby to the thug with the gun to Johnny being shot, the balcony shot of Johnny falling all the way down onto the pews. Yeah. Allowing Walken to actually cry at the very end after he sees when he's saying goodbye to her and she goes, I love you, Johnny. And you just see that tear come out of the side of Johnny's eye and roll down his face as he dies. It was really nice. Really good choices of photography in that.
Right.
Yeah.
The scene where the kids are drowning, or he sees the kids breaking through the ice and sinking to the bottom in their hockey uniforms and skates. He was actually filmed underwater seeing that happen too, but they ended up cutting it.
Oh, I didn't know that. That'd be interesting.
Yeah. I read that. I thought that was interesting. I guess it just didn't look good, or maybe Chris wasn't a good swimmer. I don't know. I don't know how it worked, but it didn't end up in the film. I don't know. I don't really have any other scenes. You mentioned the ending, and that's another big scene.
Oh, yeah.
The scene with Dodd's mother, Colleen Dewhurst.
Yeah, she's great.
Oh, my God. Bannerman goes upstairs to look for Dodd, who has disappeared because the gig is up and everyone knows he's the killer. And Colleen Dewhurst, as his mother, grabs Johnny to stop him from going. And he looks at her and he goes, you knew he was doing this. Yeah. And she's, you're the devil. Very nice Margaret White moment from another Stephen King movie. I can go on into cast since we're there pretty much.
Yeah.
And there is a lot of good people in this. Christopher Walken, we last saw him, like I mentioned. Oh, no, I didn't mention this. We last saw him in Dune 2 for our 8th season opener. You mentioned it. We did see him in Brainstorm last season as well. So he's been on a roll with us. How would you like to know Stephen King's first choice?
I would love it.
You will like Johnny even better as Chris Walken.
Why?
Bill Murray. Stephen King wanted Bill Murray to play.
Was Stephen King high at the time? He must have been high when he did that. Yeah, there's no way.
If Bill had he never really became a serious actor. He did that Razor's Edge movie, but it didn't work.
No, he can't do it. He's not a Robin Williams. Yeah, no.
And guess who David Cronenberg's choice was?
I don't know.
Nicholas Campbell, the guy that plays Frank Dodd.
Oh. See, I could see him do that.
He is a Canadian actor. He's in almost every David Cronenberg movie, and he's very good, but he's only played secondary roles. So I've never seen him in a lead role. I don't know if he could handle it, but who knows?
Possibly.
But that was vetoed because Dino said, no, you got to have a star. You got to have a star. Other people considered, you're going to laugh when I say this, but Al Pacino, Richard Gere, and Robert De Niro, they're all like, Deer Hunter actors.
Yeah, no.
Richard Gere might have worked.
Yes, actually, Richard Gere probably would have worked. And I think he's much better at the brooding sort of intensity without it being overboard, like Walken tends to do.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I can see Richard Gere.
Sorry. Brooke Adams plays Sarah, his girlfriend. I love Brooke. I especially love her because, well, she's in Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the remake, which is really good. She was in Days of Heaven, which obviously was not that good. The reason I like her is she became a secondary love interest for David Addison on Moonlighting when Sybil Shepherd was being a problem.
There you go.
So I've always liked Brooke Adams.
Yeah, she's really good in this, and I think she plays the change of time. Her hairstyle and mood and everything is better than anybody. Yeah,
mm-hmm. She does. You can see different ages in her character, for sure.
Yep.
Tom Skerritt plays Sheriff Bannerman, another genre actor. He was an Alien. We saw him in Contact not too long ago. You mentioned he was in Steel Magnolias. Guess who Cronenberg's original choice was for this role? And it's a good one.
Brian Dennehy. No, I don't know.
Hal Holbrook.
Hal Holbrook also would have been good to play Greg Stilson, too.
But he's a little old.
That's okay. Look at the presidents we've got now.
That's Come true. On. That's
so, yeah. But, yeah, Tom, I could see that. I could see Holbrook doing the Tom Skerritt. The
he's Bannerman no stranger character. To Stephen King, isn't he? Just tell it to call you Billy, bitch.
Yeah.
But Dino rejected that idea as well because he didn't know who Hal Holbrook was.
Oh, my God. See?
Speaking of people that Dino also probably did not know, Herbert Lahm Who's played great. Dr. Sam Wysack.
Yes.
Herbert Lahm, another great genre actor we last saw in the 1962 Hammer version of The Phantom of the Opera earlier this season.
Yep.
And I mentioned at the time he was also in the Pink Panther movies. He was like a villain in the Pink Panther
I think
movies
that's, with Peter that's Sellers. What he's mostly known for. He's the inspector. He's Clouseau's boss.
He's the boss. That's right. He's not the villain.
In the Pink Panther movies. And I think that's what he was probably known for at this time. People, I think, were going to see this movie in 83. That's what they thought.
I'm a bad host. I just realized I don't have pictures of these people I'm talking about. And the next one is Anthony Zerbe, who plays Roger Stewart, the rich father of the hockey player that Johnny saves, the kid that he's tutoring. The last time we saw Mr. Zerbe was way back in season 6 as Matthias in The Omega Man.
Yes. And he was great.
But yeah.
Come out, Neville.
Yeah. And he's always, he's done a lot of genre stuff, a lot of exploitative stuff too. Wasn't he in those Witch Mountain movies too, like those Disney movies in the late 70s? I think he was.
I don't know. Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, he's great. Then, as I mentioned,
he did a lot of television. He was always, he could do a Western, he could do a gangster, he could do any of it. But I remember seeing him
in. He did great bad guys. He was a great bad guy.
But I remember seeing him in everything from Bonanza to Hawaii 5-0. He was in everything.
Yeah. Colleen Dewhurst, she is new to us on the podcast, but we know her ex-husband, George C. Scott, from our recent coverage this season in The Changeling and last season in Dr. Strangelove. Now, Colleen is an incredible actress, and the first thing I thought when I watched this movie this time is, why is she playing such a small part? Mm-hmm. So I looked it up, and you want to know why?
Why?
She purposefully chose small roles in film to have more time for the stage. She was a stage actress.
Wonderful.
And that's why we see her in little character parts like
character
this.
Roles. Yeah.
And she's only got one scene in this movie and she steals it.
Yeah.
Big time. So she played Henrietta Dodd, Frank Dodd's mother.
And I remember her because not only for the George C. Scott Association, but I saw a version, I think it was a television version. It might have been film, but I think I saw it on television. But a version of The Crucible. And she was the wife, Elizabeth Proctor.
In that. Oh.
And she was awesome. She was really strong.
Yeah. I don't know. She is also, I'm pretty sure, the mother of Campbell Scott, but her and George divorced because he ended up with Trish Van Devere, who's with him in The Changeling.
Yep.
But she's a great actress. Martin Sheen plays Greg Stilson, the slimy politician that's going to blow up the world.
Hallelujah.
Yep. Hallelujah. We know him, of course, from Apocalypse Now, a little movie he did with Sissy Spacek called Badlands that I talked about, I think, in a bonus episode or something that we did. And then more recently in shows like Grace and Frankie with Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin.
Well, and he went on to be one of the greatest presidents ever portrayed in West Wing.
In the West Wing, yes, yeah. He did. But I think he's new to Johnny Has the Keys. Not Johnny Smith, Johnny Has the Keys.
I think so.
I don't think we've ever done one with him in it.
No. I don't think we've ever done a Martin Sheen film.
I don't think we have either. I'm going to have to put Little Girl Who Lives Down the Lane up on the list.
There you go.
Nicholas Campbell, as I mentioned, played Frank Dodd and was considered to play Johnny by Cronenberg. He is what I call a Cronenberg crony.
Oh, sad.
Yeah. We last saw him in The Brood, which is an earlier film by Cronenberg that I kind of, but that's just because Oliver Reed's in it. And we covered that on season 3. That was a while back.
Oh, yeah.
Sean Sullivan, that must be the henchman. I don't know. I don't really know anything about him. However, there is one other person in this movie that's familiar. Jackie Burroughs plays Vera Smith, Johnny's mother. Mm-hmm. Really religious. She is a very well-known character actress. She had 116 credits on her IMDb page. She's only 4 years older than Christopher Walken.
She doesn't look it.
No, she's got a really wrinkly face, even in this picture I'm looking at. But she was always cast as older people. She even accepted it and used to joke about it. She said, I always get cast as old people.
Okay, then.
And she's got a great death scene in this.
Yeah.
Yeah. As far as awards, the Saturns, it won Best Horror Film as far as the Saturn Awards. It was nominated for actor, director, and writing. The Avoriaz Fantastic Film Festival, it won the Suspense Award, the Critics Award, the Antenna Award, and was nominated for the Grand Prize. So it won several overseas at this place. I think that's Spain. I'm not mistaken. If it's not, it's in Europe. It won a SCADS more of Canadian awards as well. However, it's not on the 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list. I disagree with that because it is one of the better Stephen King movies, and there are 100 out there. I don't know. Anyway.
Maybe.
That's what I got for casting awards.
Those are good. The only other trivia piece I have before we go to Keys is it was Walken's idea that when Johnny has these visions, it should be very visceral. It should be like a shock to him. It should be like a jolt, he even said. And so he requested that Cronenberg take a pistol and fire it off camera whenever he wanted to literally scare him.
To startle him. Yeah.
Yeah. So that he never knows when it's going to come. That's why his jerk seems so naturalistic, because he doesn't know when Cronenberg's going to do it. But then it immediately reminded me of a Key sort of thing, whereas in The Exorcist, they didn't want him to fire a gun during the scenes, which he freaking did.
Well, no one freaking, it was probably a live round. At least Cronenberg used blanks.
Maybe. I don't know. He might have used a real blank. I don't know.
No, I read that he used blanks.
Oh, okay. Good.
Yeah, I read that too. No. He's a nice Canadian.
He's a nice Canadian director. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Who deals with body horror.
He just directs really creepy movies. I already mentioned the dead zone itself is the part of the brain. There's two different interpretations. Stephen King's was slightly different than what the movie is. But in the movie, it was the ability to change the future. There's a gap between something that's going to happen and the premonition. I've got that there were several deleted scenes, among them a prologue showing Johnny as a boy who sustained a head injury during an ice hockey match. The scene features Sean Sullivan as John's father. An alternate scene of Johnny Smith's vision of Camp David is there with Johnny in the room. That was filmed as well.
I was curious why he didn't do that then. That's the climactic vision, and he wasn't part of it.
And what is really interesting that you may remember in your subconscious is that photos of these scenes appeared in the December 1983 issue of Sin Fantastique.
Ah, okay.
And you like that magazine.
I wonder if they are in an extended version anywhere, or a director's cut.
Maybe now. They're not in the one I have, for sure.
I'd be curious. I'd be curious to see that.
And then lastly, this, as I mentioned, was the first of several Stephen King novels and short stories that took place in the fictional town of Castle Rock. Others include Cujo, Stand By Me, The Dark Half, and Needful Things. Needful Things was supposed to be where he blew it up and it was going to go away forever, but he keeps going back to it. He's still going back to it.
And an entire series called Castle Rock and
right.
Rob Reiner's production company called Castle Rock. So, yeah. I have that this was filmed in southern Ontario, right near the Niagara Falls area, that sort of thing, and that they actually used the weather as much as they could as part of the, like we said, the grayness of it, the bleakness of it. Lots of snow. And when they're outside in exterior scenes, you can see their breath, and that's real. That's not CGI and everything
else. No, it looks
good. Yeah.
It looks really good. Yeah, everything about this movie looks good to me.
Yeah, it's a well-filmed movie. I think the hair... Hair is a little weird in places.
It's '80s.
Yeah, but yeah. So you got hair wars going on.
We, as far as keys, I hardly have that many. And I don't know why, but for some reason I didn't write any down.
I had a couple of, let me do some keys and I've got a couple of questions for you.
You may trigger me.
My first key is from the very beginning. The credit sequence of this, I could tell within 30 seconds was David Greenberg. David Greenberg was a big late 70s and 80s visual effects coordinator and or graphics guy who did all these really slow reveal titles that used a type of photography or a type of superimposition that wasn't happening then, where the actual scenes crossfade between the title and whatever they're video they're showing. So this one, as you're seeing these beautiful shots of Ontario and everywhere else,
nature,
you're slowly seeing these little black things come into frame, and they all turn out to be the part of the font of Dead Zone, the title. And then it keeps going away from you as the scene is just in the letters then.
It's very
cool. Sort of thing. He did the same thing in Altered States, except it's the guy, it's William Hurt in the tank sort of thing, but it slowly develops. He did Alien, where it's only one little thing at a time that suddenly spells out Alien. Right. So he was a graphics artist that did really cool titles.
And I really, hats off to him for using the exact same font that was on the paperback book.
Or which is rare. Hardback. You don't usually see that. No, that's really cool.
No, it looked really good.
I've got, of course, as far as a key from this is the television series. It was a television series with Anthony Michael Hall that lasted, I looked at the thing and said 6 seasons. I didn't know that.
I have never seen a single one.
One episode of it. But
that is crazy. You'd think I would like it, but
interesting.
I meant to say the book is definitely a key, and I was going to say the series, but you beat me to it. I do have some that I caught from IMDb. Apparently, the book and this film are loosely based on the life of a famous psychic named Peter Hurkos.
Okay. Never heard that title.
Have you heard of him?
No.
He claimed to have acquired alleged powers after falling off a ladder and hitting his head.
Hmm. Okay.
So, apparently, he was popular. I'm sure Stephen King probably read that somewhere, and that's what spawned the idea of this book.
Not necessarily a key, but it goes into the oeuvre of King, and that's where I want to go with this, is a Firestarter. You've got his first vision is a young girl in fire sort of thing, and King has that again, of course, several times in Firestarter, which is a later book coming from this. But
and
he's also got
De Laurentiis.
Yeah. But he's also got an overly religious woman in it. And this
Carrie.
One is Johnny's mom. But that's like Carrie. Later, we talked about Mist and Mrs. Carmody and all of that. And so I was wondering, did King have an overbearing religious mother? Because
no, actually,
that kind
he
of
really
figure
liked his
in,
mother.
Okay.
His father left her. Like, it's like that textbook thing. He went out for a pack of cigarettes and never came back. So she raised him and his brother together alone, and he's got a lot of respect for his mother. If she was really religious, he's never said anything about it that I know of.
Okay.
And I don't think he's really religious, because I'm rereading Revival right now, and it doesn't sound like it.
I'm just curious, because he tends to make religious people evil. They're bad. Yeah. What was the one where the guy has a piece of no, that's the Blob, where the religious guy at the revival at the end. But anyway.
Yeah, but he did that Midnight Mass. That's actually Flanagan. That's not King.
Yeah.
It reminds me of King a lot.
another key from this is Maximum Overdrive and Pet Sematary. This thing that King has about big rigs. Big rigs are scary. And I agree with him. I think big, huge semi trucks are scary and can be scary. In this one, it's a milk truck, but it's a beer truck, I think, in Pet Sematary.
It's such a slice of time.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the movies that you're talking about came out at the same time. Mm-hmm. A lot of them were Dino De Laurentiis movies that were filmed in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Yep.
whether or not they're set in Castle Rock. I think, actually, Pet Sematary is the only exclusion. That was filmed in the late 80s. These were all filmed in the early 80s. But yeah. That's funny. Yeah, I'll put them down, because Ethan King wrote really is a key.
Yeah, a religious obsession and big rigs sort of thing.
I have one other key that I will mention that and it's not really a key, but I can't not say that he is not only teaching Edgar Allan Poe, he is teaching Washington Irving's The Legend of Sleepy Hollow.
Sleepy Hollow,
and
yeah.
Christopher Walken played the Headless Horseman in Tim Burton's Sleepy Hollow, which we covered a few Halloweens back. Well, I would have both of those, actually, Poe and...
But also, I think Johnny sees himself as a Sleepy Hollow, Ichabod character.
He's
who's
more
ostracized.
Like, more like Rip Van Winkle.
That too. Yeah, that's a great
influence.
And that's
Washington Irving as well. Somebody that slept his entire life away. Yeah.
That's a good key. Yeah. I've got, I mentioned that Martin Sheen, we see him again as a president in West Wing, but I've also got this whole overlay of assassination. So JFK's assassination, when he goes and first gets out of the taxi and looks up and you see the building and everything else, I'm thinking Book Depository in my head. But then the whole Lincoln assassination, because he literally falls off the balcony kind of thing and falls off of the back of the church. Or wherever this hall is that they're doing this.
Yeah, it looks like a church. It does look like a church.
And in this one, he pulls down the American flag. And supposedly Booth got his spur caught on an American flag. That's why he hurt his leg. But this whole political assassination of undertone.
Yeah, I don't know how to put that down as a link.
You could put down.
Political assassination histories.
Later on, King wrote the JFK assassination,
11/22/63. Yeah, that's actually not a bad one, too, to put as a key, because he is definitely trying to change the future in that one.
Yeah, the last third of this movie is 11/22/63. If you can change the past, would you? Thing. That dilemma and that question that's always been there.
It's funny how Stephen King goes back to all these things. People make fun of him because half of his characters are writers.
Yeah.
Or he revisits the same trope. But look how many damn books he's written. He's written like 60 books. He hit the same thing a few times.
But it still works. Religion. If it ain't broke, don't fix it things. Because we can easily see a writer having a more, I think we mentioned it was, I mentioned with Silent Secret Window that I watched recently, with this whole thing of we can empathize with writers who see things that other people don't, because they're writers. Their imagination is their fuel. So it's easy for them to see ghosts or to have visions or to run around the hotel and want to kill your family or whatever. So we can see writers being that way. So why not keep doing it thing? And there are tropes that he goes back to, but they seem to work, I think. That's why he is the
the writer that he is.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I don't regret it at all. I don't regret much that he's ever done. There are a few books that are a little bit of a clunker, but...
And my last thing, not to delve political at all, but my last note was, see, even back then, politicians were totally corrupt. And if they were populist, they could attract followers. Just say, God bless America. There you go. It's been going on for 250 years.
Yeah, we've been dancing around the big elephant in the room. But Greg Stilson is such a Trump-like character.
Oh, my gosh.
Who?
A liar and a manipulator and probably a murderer.
A bully.
Yeah. Total bully. Yeah. It was, but I really enjoyed watching this again. I'm glad you put it on the list. I hadn't seen it in a while.
Yeah, me too.
And so that brings us to the end of this. That's what Tim and I think. We'd love to know what you guys think. Let us know down below. Do you like The Dead Zone? What do you know about the series that we don't know since neither one of us have seen it? I like Anthony Michael Hall, but not enough for 6 years of the same character, maybe. I don't know. I might delve into it at one point, but let us know. Also subscribe, ring the bell, do all those kind of things. If you can pop on Apple and give us a review, it always helps us get other people and find new people who might be interested in either the YouTube channel or the podcast. And if you are new and like what you heard or saw today, look at the list down below. We've got tons of other episodes and other films and series even and everything else. And if you would, please, please consider supporting us. We do have a Patreon. You can go on there and we have free content, but also some tiered content, including other podcasts that we've done, like Dilithium Chamber, which examines Star Trek, and X-Files Declassified, where we go episode by episode through the X-Files or the series itself. Before the reboot comes out next year or whenever. But yeah. Tim, are we still scary next week? Are we more fun?
You know,
are we more?
We're going back into fantasy land.
We're doing fantasy. So those of you who've come to Johnny Has the Keys before know that it's been horror and science fiction, but lately we've opened it up for suspense and fantasy as well. So expanding our repertoire, as it were. We'll be there
now. That doesn't mean we're not going to go out with a bang as far as horror and science fiction, because I think we have 5 episodes left. And one's a horror double feature, one's a horror classic redux, one's a sci-fi classic redux, and the other's a big blockbuster.
Maybe. Yeah, there you go. Still science fiction, but blockbuster, yeah.
And this is a fantasy blockbuster.
Yeah. All right.
We're ready.
I'll see you in another fantasy land next week.
Sounds good.
All right.